Hello and welcome. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. It's the show where I review every science fiction book that I read as I read it, except not at the moment because I'm a bit behind and I've been really busy. I've been away out the country for a while and doing other podcast projects and things like that. So this, you know, I read this book not just recently. It was about maybe 3 weeks ago when I read this book, probably a little bit more. But I always write down notes as I read these books, so I've got it all fresh in my mind after reviewing my notes again. So the book that I'm going to be reviewing today is called Singularity Sky by Charles Stross, and it was published 2004, that is. So again, quite a recent book, not his latest book. I think there's a but like another book in the same universe. I'm not sure if it's a sequel or not, but there you go. So let's just first set up this book. I actually heard good things about this book and about Charles Stross as an author. I think this book, actually, I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was nominated for a Hugo Award, and the sequel was as well. So, you know, I knew it would be pretty good. I had high hopes for it. So, like I say, the setting up the universe. The Singularity Sky that we're talking about is the universe, because sometime in the future, it says mid-21st century, a singularity event occurs. And that's like when a computer, you know, it improves more and more and more exponentially until it becomes so far beyond humans, it might as well be a god. And that's what happens. So this god, he actually makes it very clear, he's not their god, but he calls himself Eschaton. Bum, bum. Boom! So, a super advanced computer, and he can pretty much do anything he wants, you know, so far advanced that's indistinguishable from magic, that whole kind of thing. So first of all, he works out how to get faster than light travel, and then he works out time travel as well, and he looks backwards in time and forwards in time, and he realizes that nobody else yet, as far as he can see, has discovered time travel. So what he does, he's very paranoid, he bans all time travel by anyone and any kind of singularity event by any humans from then on, because he doesn't want anybody else to travel back in time to before he's created and stop the creation of himself. He's very paranoid in that way. So that's a pretty cool device. Also, he decides to solve humanity's problems, or maybe not solve them, but like restrict them in certain ways. And he gathers up 90% of the world's population, 10 billion people by that point or something, and he removes them away and spreads them out around the solar system, not around the solar system, around the galaxy. And the key thing here is that through some weird time travel setup, the further away these populations go to other solar systems and other planets, the further back in time they're taken. So if you're taken 4,000 parsecs away, you've been taken back 4,000 years in time. So as these humans sort of develop the technology further and then come back towards Earth, outside of Earth is far more developed than Earth has been left itself. So it's one of those weird things, because normally in these sort of big space operas, Earth is a shining beacon of advanced technology, and the further away that you get becomes more primitive and more frontier town-like, but it's the opposite in this, which is quite interesting. And also, there's lots of different, you know, different enclaves, little republics and empires set up, and they sort of conquer different planets around their sort of main planet and take over. And that's pretty much the setup. The story begins, I think, a few thousand years after the singularity event. A few thousand years, that is, for people on Earth. But, of course, other people, it's happened 6,000 years later and stuff like that. So there's this spaceship, super-advanced spaceship with super-advanced people or robots or minds, intelligence on board, called the Festival. And that arrives at a planet called Roshard's World. And that's part of an empire called the New Republic. And that's a very regressive society. Don't like a lot of modern technology, sort of restrict, you know, freedoms, down on women and all that kind of stuff, a feudal society. The Festival has one mission, and that is to gain knowledge, and they pay for the knowledge, or other entertainments or stories or anything like that, and they pay for it with anything that the person giving the knowledge wants. They have what's known as a cornucopia machine, which just churn out anything, literally anything that fits through a doorway, it spits out and there it is, you can make it. So of course this feudal society on this planet gets turned upside down, and the New Republic, back at their home world, they lose contact with the planet and they presume it's been attacked. And in a way it has been, but it's not been attacked in a normal kind of sort of military attack that they would be used to. So this very backwards fleet, or this backwards empire, puts together a fleet of sort of like rickety old spaceships and send them out to like battle against the Festival. And to gain the element of surprise, they devise this plan where they bounce backwards and forwards through time, through space and time, that is. It takes a long time to do it, but they'll arrive just after the Festival has, even though it's going to take them months and months to get there, and they twist it round. So it is a form of time travel, and this has been banned by Esherton, and they think they can get away with it, and that, you know, you find out if they do or not as they go along. So that's, like I say, the setup. And unfortunately, I don't think I've spoiled anything for you, because you're being... What can I say here? The thing is, I'm actually telling you the setup, that some things that you should know to enjoy at the beginning of the book. The thing is, you don't get told this until like a quarter of the way through, then half the way through, even sort of three quarters of the way through. A lot of the setup that I've just given you, you're not told. So I was just reading it thinking, but what's happening here? Why doesn't this work? And then you sort of find out halfway through and you go, and why is this doing this? I don't understand. And then you get told and it's like, So there wasn't for me in this book any mystery at all, just confusion. It wasn't like I was finding, I'm wondering about this. I'm wondering about that. What's going on here? I'm just thinking, well, this is a bit weird. This is a bit crap. And then, you know, there's an explanation, and the explanation doesn't really—it's not really satisfying. It's just a load of techno babble, which sort of makes sounds a bit impressive. Actually, I wrote down in my notes here a classic example of this from page 46. It just goes, accelerating to speeds faster than light was, of course, impossible. General relativity had made it clear that. Clear enough back in the 20th century. However, since then, a number of ways of circumventing the speed limit had turned up. By now, there was at least six different known methods of moving mass or information from A to B without going through C. C, you know, in sort of speed of light. Yeah, very clever, that kind of thing. And then he just goes on to babble through about all these sort of, like, Bose-Einstein condensation, flip bits, quantum dots, separated by light. And, of course, some of it makes sense, but it's like, Does it really make sense? Do you really need all of that in there? And does it add to the story in any way? And there was all of this set. And now I really like this. I really like gadgets. I really like technology. I like understanding some of the concepts behind it. But, you know, the thing, it's just sort of like a device in a way. Like, you know, in a film where you sort of like the hero gets cut off from the world because, you know, they pick out the mobile phone and they just look at it and go, no signal, and they throw their phone away. They just throw it on the floor and stamp in it almost. And then they can't call the cops or can't call in air support or can't call the boss or anything. So they run after the baddie themselves and kill the baddie themselves. And you want that. It's a convention these days in films that, the no signal on the cell phone. But we just accept it because in a film we really want to see the hero just go and kick some ass. Whereas in this film, pretty much the same kind of thing happens. You know, the main hero gets separated from his boss, but the way it's explained, you just go and it doesn't really earn it, because you're not actually left. The concept is there, it's logical, it's quite interesting, but the story and the characters aren't engaging enough for me to happy with just to go with a sort of like the now he has no signal on a cell phone, you know, which is just old in that way. A bit about the characters on the Rochard's world, you know, the planet that's visited by the festival. We follow some guys doing, walking about and talking about stuff and looking at stuff, and there's nothing really a consequence happens. It's just he is our eyes to see what happens when a feudal society suddenly has access to literally any technology or knowledge or anything that they'd want. But it doesn't really add very much to the story itself, because the main plot is happening on the space fleet going towards Rochard's world. And there's in the festival that you meet some characters in there, but you know, not a lot to talk about there either. The main characters that you follow are Martin Springfield. He's a technician. He's a faster-than-light drive technician, a jump ship technician working on the New Republic starship fleet, because they're all old crap starships. But yeah, he's working on improving them so they can actually travel better. The flagship is called the Lord Vanek, and he just happens to be working on the ship when the ship sets off. It could be an accident, maybe not. Also, there's the United Nations on Earth, which isn't any kind of... It's sort of a political power in the world or in the galaxy, but not that much. And they think that with this newly upgraded fleet, they might have a go at time travelling and upset the Esherton, upset the Singularity. So they send an agent on board, and her name is Rachel Mansour. And, of course, she's the very predictable love interest in the book, of course, because she's the only female character in the book. There are other secondary characters in the fleet, the Admiral and various generals and random minor characters, a few random minor characters who seem a little bit overdeveloped for someone who has such a minor role. And you go, I think they might come into the story a bit more later. And you'd think right at that point. So all of the characters, very, very weak, you know, both the leads and the supporters. supporting cast. They're very, of course, one-dimensional. I mean, because they're just symbols, really. Chess pieces for Charles Stross to sort of move around. It's, oh, this person does this, and then this person does this. And there's very, very little development at all in any of the characters from beginning to the end. And the story itself, again, I can't really spoil the story very much because it doesn't really go anywhere. The first third of the book, it talks about the fleet setting up and getting ready and, you know, the reasons why they're getting ready. And the two main characters, they have sex, like, straight away in the first quarter of the book or so. Of course, you want the sex to happen because, you know, it's a love interest in there. But when it does happen, of course, after that, there's just no sexual tension. There's nothing left there between the relationship. And it doesn't really develop, except that Rachel thinks that, you know, sleeping with a technician might get in the way of a job, you know, something like that. There's very, very little else going on there in that relationship. And then there's a little twist when you find out who Martin Springfield is really working for. But it's like you've guessed it already. Again, just to explain something to Charles Stross here, if you explain that there's, like, you know, just off the top of my head, five different political powers or institutions or something like that in the book, and then you introduce five different characters and you say, well, this person is doing this one, and this person is working for that one, and this person is working for that one, and this person is working for that one, but the fifth one, I won't tell you who he's working for. And then, of course, you find out he's working for the fifth political power, and it's meant to be sort of like some kind of twist, but you just read it and go, yep, oh. Okay, so the setup and the second half of the book plods along with nothing much happening, and they're travelling, and it's taking ages to read the book. It's like the opposite of a page turner, you know, because you're just reading it. Okay, get on with it. I mean, like I say, I'm not knocking all the cool stuff because there's a lot of cool technology in there, but, you know, you get to the end of the book and the fleet arrives and the battle festival, and there's like some twists at the end of the book where you just go, because they don't explain anything and they've got no effect on the story or any effect on the characters, and it doesn't actually interest you what's going on. It just plods through, gets to the end, the heroes, well, of course they survive because, well, you know, there's a sequel, and it just ends. And, you know, I think really Charles Stross, he's confused mystery, like keeping like a mystery in a book and keeping people in suspense with just keeping the audience in ignorance, because it's like the only thing I was actually reading through the book for was to find out like what cool technology is going to happen or what cool thing is going to happen later on. But you know, there could have been themes in the book and there could have been all this, but it kept me at such an arm's length that I didn't really want to get deeply into the book to really think about the themes that he was talking about. Again, gadgets cool, but just doesn't really affect me. I didn't really care about it so much. You know, I really like books filled with like really heavy and advanced technologies. For example, like the cornucopia machine, I've seen it done so much better in previous books. Will McCarthy's series Collapsium and then the Wellstone and stuff like that, they also have these cornucopia machines where you can put anything in and get anything out as long as it's programmed. And again, in the Wellstone, there's a really great sequence where the people are on this spaceship and they have to get off, and not quite the same situation, but again, trying to get off a spaceship in space, and you've got to jerry-rig the technology to do it, happens in both the Wellstone and in Singularity Sky. But in the Wellstone, I really, really cared. And in Singularity Sky, I was just like, cool technology, but, you know, did I care that they're going to get off the ship or not? Not really anything like that at all. So I'll wrap this review up just by giving it 2.5 stars out of 5, which means check it out if you've got nothing else to read, because it isn't all bad, you know. And there is a sequel, and I probably will read the sequel, because the ideas in the book, you know, the technological ideas and some of the social ideas are pretty good. But like I say, the whole book itself, the story was so bad and the characters were so like, that, you know, I just really couldn't get into the book. It wasn't a struggle to get through to the end, because it's only a few hundred pages long. It only takes a few hours to read through. Well, I say a few hours, a few days to read through. So 365 or something pages to go. So not too bad, but you know. Doesn't really get me. Unlike the next book that I'm reviewing, which again I already read a few weeks ago, called Variable Star by Robert A. Heinlein and Spider Robinson. And there is a book which really pulls you in, and it's got layers and layers of meaning. And, you know, when something happens halfway through that book, it really happens and it really hits you. But more on that on the next podcast, of course, which will be up in a few days' time once I've recorded it and put it up. I'll probably record it this evening, but put it up on the feed in a few days' time to let people download this and listen to it. One final note. I'd actually forgotten the title of Collapsium, because it's not a name really that sticks in your head, and I couldn't remember the author off the top of my head either. But of course I remember the books and the characters in the books and the events in the books. Really great. And there was this one phrase that sticks out, and I think in the third book, where he says, "You squoze the moon," squeezing the moon down. And so I just typed in "squoze the moon" into Google, and it came up first hit. You know, well, not the book I was looking for, but the latest book in the series, or the next book in the series, which I haven't read yet. And I really, like, really enjoy living in this science fiction world. You know, these sci-fi books that you'd read 10 years ago would predict that we'd have knowledge at our fingertip, wherever we were in the world, within, you know, 50 years, you know. And we've got it now, of course. I was, like, in Hong Kong the other day, you know, Wi-Fi all over the place. Just get my laptop out. Where am I? Open it up. Google Earth. Where? There I am. And, yeah, it was really, really handy. Of course, the Collapsium series I really enjoyed. The first two books specifically. The third book, probably won't read that again. But I think I'm going to go back before I read the next one in the series. Go back and read the first two books, because I really enjoyed them. The third one was, of course, a lot weaker than the first, because I just lost track a bit. So there you go. That's the end of the podcast. Email me. Thanks for the feedback. Thanks for the other book recommendations. Email me, luke@juggler.net. I'm actually disabled comments on the blog, because all I'm getting is spam, and only two people commented on that anyway. So, of course, it's a podcast. All you do is download it automatically by iTunes. You probably don't even look at the blog. So, yeah, email me. That's the only way to get in touch these days. I hope you've enjoyed this. Catch you later.